Black colleges and universities in the United States have also educated prominent Africans, like the founding presidents of Nigeria, Ghana, and Malawi. The role of historically Black colleges and universities on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports. Highlighting some of Wednesday's results at the 12th African Games in Morocco, riders from Namibia and South Africa won the gold medals in the men's and women's cycling mountain bike cross-country events. The men's course covered just over 30 kilometers, and the winner was Namibian cyclist Tristan De Lange in 1 hour, 24 minutes, and 45 seconds. The women's course also covered just over 30 kilometers, and the winner was the South African Tiffany Kiep in 1 hour, 19 minutes, and 15 seconds. In rowing Wednesday at the African Games, 4 gold medals were awarded in the single sculls 1,000 meters event. It was a very good day for Algeria on the water. 3 Algerians won gold medals, Nawel Chiali, Amina Ruba, and Sid Ali Boudina. The other gold medal in men's single sculls rowing went to Tunisia's Mohamed Taib. Now, this marks the first time Morocco has hosted the African Games. And with more sporty action left on Wednesday, let's take a quick look at the medal table. North African countries are at the top right now. Egypt ranks first with 14 medals, 5 gold, 4 silver, and 5 bronze. Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia are second, third, and fourth, respectively, on the games medal table. The Algerians have 15 medals total, while Morocco and Tunisia have won 13 each. Turning to athletics, Jeffrey Kamwar and Agnes Tirop won the men's and women's 10,000 meters titles Wednesday at the Kenyan Championships in Nairobi. The 26-year-old Kamwar is a 3-time world half marathon champion, as well as a 2-time world cross-country champion. Jeffrey won the men's race Wednesday in 27 minutes and 24.76 seconds. Ronex Kipruto finished second in 27 minutes and 26.34 seconds, just ahead of Rogers Kwemoy. The top 3 runners in the race earned places on the Kenyan team at next month's World Championships in Doha. The women's 10,000 meters race in Nairobi was even closer than the men's, as a little more than 1 second separated the top 3 finishers. Agnes Tirop, the 2015 World Cross Country Champion, took top honors in 31 minutes and 25 seconds. Reigning 5,000 meters world champion Helen Obiri was second, and Rosemary Wanjiru was third. So, Tirop, Obiri, and Wanjiru also booked their places on the Kenyan team for the World Championships in Doha. The Kenyan Championships are one of the most competitive national trials ahead of the World Championships. The Kenyans will hold competition in other disciplines on September 12th and September 13th. The World Championships are scheduled to officially open September 27th in Doha.
Hello, sports fans. This is Paul Tergat, marathon champion from Kenya. You are listening to the Sony Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
I had the voice of America calling on my wavelength. A man was coming out of Frankfurt, I made. I had the voice of America drowning on my wavelength. Singing, come back, baby, come back. Come back, baby, come back.
If you were to talk to us from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your heart. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
And my Voice of America colleague, Shaka Sali, will be waiting for you Wednesday night at 18:30 UTC GMT with another edition of Straight Talk Africa. One of my favorite Shaka interviews on Straight Talk Africa took place 3 years ago, shortly after the death of boxing great Muhammad Ali. Shaka asked another former world heavyweight champion, Larry Holmes, for his reaction to Ali's passing.
It hurt me because not only he was a friend of mine, but I think he was one of the greatest fighters ever lived in this world.
You happen to be one of the elite five boxers that, in fact, defeated at one time Muhammad Ali. But yet again, you happen perhaps to be a very unique individual, given that you were his former sparring partner, a friend, and of course, eventually a world heavyweight champion. What was it like to fight Muhammad Ali?
It was a good pleasure fighting Muhammad because, you know, he was my friend and he was my boss. And then I had to fight him, you know, but then it was the money thing, you know. If I beat him, I'd be the old man. If I lost, I never had anything. So, you know, my thing was not to take it hard on him because, you know, I knew how he would fight. And I knew that I could beat him. So I don't want to hurt Muhammad Ali because he is my friend. And so when we fought, you know, I told him, don't get hurt. Just don't go crazy. I'd be like, I don't want to hurt nobody. I don't want you to be hurt. And, you know, he told me, shut up and fight, you know. And I did what I had to do without hurting him, I think. I don't think I hurt him. And, you know, we remained friends because right after the fight, I went back to his dressing room and I told him, I gave him a hug and told him I love him. And he said, if you love me, why you beat me up like that, man? So, you know, he was a great man. And he wasn't angry with me or nothing like that because it was about the money. He got $10 million and, you know, back then, that was a lot of money, you know? So he was happy, and we remained friends even after the fight.
Any particular reason, Larry, why you cried after the bout? You don't seem really to have enjoyed the fight.
I don't enjoy the fight. He was my friend. He was my boss, you know what I mean? You know, he was a guy that helped teach me how to fight. I mean, when I first went with him in 1971, I was just an amateur. I was learning how to fight. And he gave me the opportunity to come to his camp and work out with him and learn from him. He gave me that opportunity. When I worked out with Muhammad Ali for the very first time, we went to Reading, Pennsylvania. He gave me gloves and shoes, everything to box with. And he gave me the opportunity to box. And when he boxed with me, of course, he gave me the black eye, right? He gave me the black eye, and I loved it. And I said, it's okay. he wanted to put ice on my eye, and I won't let him put ice because why? I said, because I'm showing this off, Muhammad Ali hit me in my eye. I said, this is nice. I can show it off. And, you know, he told me I was crazy, put the ice, but I never put ice. And then when I got home, I bragged about Muhammad Ali boxing me and giving me a black eye. It was a brag. Yeah, I bragged about it.
Now, knowing him the way you did, and of course you have to be one of the few very unique individuals that do that, do you sincerely feel, do you sincerely think that it was necessary for Muhammad Ali to fight the last two fights? I'm talking about yours and the one of Trevor Babik in the Bahamas.
Yeah, well, Trevor Babik didn't need to fight, but what it was about was the money. It was about the money with Ali. He started fighting for money after he couldn't beat me. He just said, I'll take a fight with money. And I didn't like that fight. I didn't think he should have took it. But again, you can't tell people what to do because, you know, the man, when I tell him that he's the champ, I said, shut up. He can do what he want to do, so I don't say anything. Well, if he was the champ, in my opinion, he was always going to be the champ. So, you know, the Babik fight, the Trevor Babik fight, Trevor Babik didn't fight the Ali that I fought. If he did, he would have got beat.
You, again, happen to be one of the few people that interacted with him in a very special manner. What is it that during that experience, really, that you learned? What did you learn from him, and what did that interaction mean to you?
Hey, listen, I got the best jab in boxing. I had the best jab in boxing because of Muhammad Ali. Because I tried to keep up with him, and when he threw the jab, I want to throw the jab. I want to beat him to the jab because everybody knew how Ali was. Everybody knew that he was a good jabber. He always jabbed right-hand combination. And I wanted to be like that, so I worked on that to beat him to the jab. And that's why I lasted so long in boxing because I had a good jab. Everybody had to worry about the Larry Holmes jab. And then when they worried about the Larry Holmes jab, then they had to worry about the right. And so they couldn't do both. And I was able to win the fight.
What was it like being with him in Zaire back in 1974? I'm talking about the Rambo in the jungle.
In the jungle. I was there with him. I was there with Muhammad Ali, the Rambo in the jungle, in Zaire. And he trained good. I mean, you know, people love him. Ali Boumaye. Ali Boumaye.
I'll kill him.
Yeah. And, you know, there's all a lot of people that we that didn't speak good English, but they know how to say Ali Boumaye. We didn't know how to speak African, so we said Ali Boumaye. You know, we said the same thing, Ali Boumaye. Ali Boumaye. And it was neat. And people, everywhere you go, people love you. You know, they run after, they take little kids running behind the car, Ali, Ali, Ali. I mean, you know, it was mind-boggling. And you know what Ali said? He said, boy, he said, you're home. This is home, man. This is what our people look like. This is what we look like. And you know, he was very proud to be in Zaire. And I was just as proud as he was because I was with the greatest fighter of all time.
Any particular reason why the people preferred Ali to the champion himself, George Foreman?
George Foreman, though, it was okay boxing. But, you know, but George Foreman, they didn't like George Foreman. I mean, you know, because Ali, they loved Ali, they didn't like George Foreman. Because George Foreman wasn't no Muhammad Ali. Everywhere Ali go, people go with him. But George, they didn't do that with George. That's okay, because I didn't like George either.
I see. Have you been to Africa, Lale, since 1974?
I did not go to Zaire, but I've been to different parts of Africa already. Yeah, I've been to different parts.
What is it like to be a world heavyweight champion of the world? And you were for many years.
Well, it was an honor to be the heavyweight champion of the world. It's an honor to represent black fighters that could be able to do something. It was great to honor white fighters if they work hard enough, they can be something. You know, it means something when anybody that work hard as I work can be anything that they want to be. You know, whether you're black, whether white, or orange, or green color, I don't care. If you work at something, you can always be that. Ali was living proof that if you work at it, you can be it. And he was one example. He moralized boxing. And he would go down as one of the greatest fighters of all time. And I'm just glad to say that I was one of the guys who helped him become one of the great fighters of all time.
That's former world heavyweight boxing champion Larry Holmes. And Larry was talking with my VOA colleague Shaka Sali on our Straight Talk Africa show. And that interview was originally broadcast in 2016. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. It's time for a Sunny Side of Sports official correction. During Tuesday's show, I said Olympic and World Heptathlon champion Nafi Thiam was born in Brussels to a Belgian mother and a Senegalese father. Well, I got Nafi's parentage right, but I got her birthplace wrong. Nafi was actually born in Namur, Belgium. Nafi won the women's long jump event last weekend at the Muller Grand Prix meet in Birmingham, England. She twice broke her own Belgian national record and had a winning leap of 6 meters 86. Like Nafi Thiam, Jamaica's Omar McLeod is the reigning Olympic and world champion in his event, the men's 110 meters hurdles. Omar won his race at the Muller Grand Prix in 13.21 seconds, and afterwards, the energetic Andy Edwards caught up with the Jamaican star. Here's Andy.
Omar, what does this win tell you about where you are this season, a world championship season, and what you have to do to be, well, winning yet another world title?
It means a lot. It was a head win, and I know me so well that I know that once I'm healthy and I'm in the right environment with the right coach, trust me, I'm going to be okay. And, you know, I wanted to make sure that I put myself in a situation where, you know, I'm the defending champion, and I don't take that lightly. And I want to be able to go to Doha saying that I'm ready, I am prepared. And if you're going to come take the title from me, I have a wall up, and you're going to have to take me down for it, you know. So I just want to make sure that I'm in the right situation to be prepared. I don't want to be unsure. I don't want to have doubts. I want to be ready. And today was a stepping stone in the right direction.
And anything in particular that you could reveal you want to be working on? I mean, not just from what you learned from this win in Birmingham, but in recent races?
Yeah, my coach told me just to go have fun. He said, set up the first three hurdles, get out in front, take control, do what you do best. You know, and I went with him and he was just like, you know what, we're going to focus on what works for you. And he knows me race, he knows my race in and out. And he told me exactly what I need to go do. He was like, no pressure, you're in shape, you're getting back into it. You know, we've adjusted the small things that you need to work on and you're ready to go. You know, so I needed to just trust that. And
there's no injury problems, no little niggles?
Yeah, a few here and there. My ankle, I twisted my ankle in London. We're working on that too. Like I said, it's a work in progress with my quad. My quad is good now. I had a quad issue and he's good now. Wrist issue is getting better. And so I was banged up all over, especially from the falling robot. But I'm the athlete. I don't make excuses. I go out and show up, you know, and do the best that I can. But I'm healthy now. I'm getting there. And I have time.
Omar, all the best.
Thank you so much.
That's Omar McLeod, the reigning Olympic and world champion in the men's 110 meters hurdles. And Omar was talking with the energetic Andy Edwards in Birmingham, England.
Hi, this is Andre DeGrasse, three-time Olympic sprint medalist, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America.
South Africa's women mountaineers are reaching new heights. In May, South African businesswoman Sarah Kumalo became the first Black African woman to summit Mount Everest. Now, four other South Africans are training to become the first all-women African team to climb the world's tallest peak. In this encore Sunny Side of Sports presentation, Marisa de Klerk reports from Waterval Boven, South Africa.
Is there a specific way to do this, or just through and through? But your hand
through.
Has to do
and this? That specific one. Yeah, you got like it right. This. That's it. Perfect.
Deshaun Dysel, Lisa Gehring, Tumi Mpahlele and Alda Waddell are training on the sandstone cliffs of South Africa's Drakensberg Mountains. They hope that next year they can become the first team of African women to conquer Mount Everest. The women are inspired by South African business executive Sarah Kumalu, who in May became the first black African woman to climb the world's highest mountain, which stands 8,848 meters tall. Africa has few mountains to practice on, but Kumalu says that is not a problem.
What excites me even more is that those coming behind us, or behind me, effectively won't have to struggle as much as I have had. You know, even though we're not born in a place where there are mountains, there's ice and snow, and more so when the ladies go in next year, I think it's going to open up even more doors.
Each team member does their own intensive mental and physical training along with group sessions to prepare for the difficult climb. Alda Waddell explains.
There's different elements that you need to train for. It is the technical, the equipment that you need to understand. It is the physical that you need to be able to do. And then also the cold. You need to be able to manage the cold. And then lastly is the altitude.
The inside looks like a...
Oh, yes.
Looks like a...
Sure.
Boxing boot.
The women have different levels of experience in mountaineering. In 1996, Deshaun Dysel became the first black South African woman to set foot on Mount Everest. While she wasn't able to reach the summit, she scaled mountains on five continents.
When I first started high altitude climbing, there were so few women in the mountains. If I look around now, especially in the South African climbing community, that number definitely increased. And because of that, we have a greater pool of women to choose from. So why not have an all-female team?
As South African businesswomen, the team sees parallels with running a business in a male-dominated world and climbing the world's tallest mountain. They want their attempt to scale Mount Everest to inspire more African women to reach for the top. Marise de Klerk for VOA News, Waterval Boven, South Africa.
Thanks, Marisa. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America.
It is with great honor and an incredible pleasure for me to announce that St. Louis will be the 28th team in Major League Soccer. Congratulations.
That's Major League Soccer Commissioner Don Garber congratulating St. Louis after it was awarded an expansion franchise. The team will begin playing in 2022 in a new downtown soccer stadium. And as Commissioner Garber said, it will be the league's 28th team. The St. Louis franchise also is the first female majority-owned team in Major League Soccer history. It's led by members of the founding family of the car rental company, Enterprise. Carolyn Kendall Betts is the president of Enterprise Holdings Foundation.
Thank you, Commissioner Garber. And on behalf of our families, we cannot thank you and the other MLS owners enough for believing in the city that we truly love and care so much about. So for months, I've been trying to convey the excitement that is happening right here, right now in this room, and there are absolutely no words to accurately describe it. It was this excitement and support from the fans in this room and throughout the region that inspired the ownership group to come together to pursue this endeavor, but it also kept us motivated and focused.
And thanks to MLSsoccer.com for that audio. The new Major League Soccer franchise in St. Louis will join the Stanley Cup ice hockey champion St. Louis Blues and the 11-time World Series baseball champion St. Louis Cardinals as the city's major sports teams. The new team is expected to be very popular in St. Louis, which has a deep history of supporting soccer. With the addition of the team in St. Louis, 18 clubs have now joined Major League Soccer since 2005, and they've helped transform the landscape of professional soccer across North America. FC Cincinnati joined MLS as the 24th team this season. Nashville SC and Inter Miami CF will debut in 2020, followed by Austin FC in 2021. Major League Soccer announced in April that it plans to expand to 30 teams. And that wraps up the August 21st edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer Rob McLean. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
I get it.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, historically black colleges and universities in the United States have also educated prominent Africans, like the founding presidents of Nigeria, Ghana, and Malawi. The role of historically black colleges and universities on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is James Butty, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers at the University of Chicago found evidence that supports a link between exposure to environmental pollution and neuropsychiatric disorders such as bipolar disorder and depression. The researchers analyzed information from a U.S. health insurance database which contained neuropsychiatric disease claims for 151 million people. They then compared patient location information from the health insurance database to U.S. Environmental Protection Agency measurements taken in various U.S. localities of 87 potential air pollutants. According to the study, the U.S. counties with the worst air quality also had a 27% increase in bipolar disorder and a 6% increase in major depression compared to areas with the best air quality. The researchers were able to validate their U.S. findings by applying their methodology to data called from similar data sets in Denmark. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Hello, thank you for listening to Border Crossings with Larry London. This month, Border Crossings is giving away a really cool Voice of America t-shirt. Hooray! If you want to win one of these awesome shirts, all you have to do is make a song request for our show. I see it, I like it, I want it, I got it, yeah. Tune into Border Crossings at 1500 Universal Time every weekday in August for your chance to win.
Thank you.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our program.